The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Lung Cancer and Paraneoplastic Syndromes is presented by Dr. Amita Vasoya.
So if you look at lung cancer, it is the most common cause of mortality worldwide. It's pretty impressive, and it surpasses colon, breast, pancreas, and prostate. It accounts for millions of deaths per year. In the United States alone, in 2012, there were over 200,000 new cases. Unfortunately, the five-year survival rate for lung cancer has not improved over the last 30 years. If you look, the red bar is from 1975 to 1977, and then the blue bar is the early 2000s, and you can see how much headway we've not made. The biggest risk factor for lung cancer is smoking. Again, you also want to keep in mind environmental exposures, air pollution, occupational exposures, radon, metals, whatever the case may be. Always, always, always ask about occupational exposure. Asbestos is a big one. Genetics always play a role in any kind of cancer. Keep that in mind. Radiation therapy, pulmonary fibrosis, all of those things increase your risk for lung cancer. But by far, active smoking accounts for the most cases of lung cancer. You can get lung cancer in non-smokers. I've seen it. Definitely, it is possible. So don't evaluate your non-smoker. Evaluate them as well if you think it's clinically relevant. Benign lung neoplasms and malignant neoplasms, we're going to go through both. I'm going to focus the majority of this talk on malignant neoplasms, but just for completeness sake, some of the benign neoplasms include papillomas, hematomas, fibrous tumors, and of those, the most common is probably adenomas and hematomas. The malignant neoplasms account for the majority of lung tumors, they're classified as non-small cell lung cancer and small cell lung cancer, and then you have primary pulmonary lymphoma, which I'm not going to go into. And when you look at non-small cell lung cancer, there's further subdivided into squamous cell, adenocarcinoma being the most common, large cell, and carcinoid. The previous nomenclature bronchoalveolar cell is no longer. We've dropped that several years ago, and it's now subdivided into atypical adenomatous hyperplasia, adenomacarcinoma in situ, and minimally invasive adenocarcinoma. You're not going to require to know that, but just know that there is a new definition, new nomenclature. This slide emphasizes the point that the incidence of lung cancer is far greater in smokers than non-smokers for all the cell types. We'll talk about small cell lung cancer. Generally, it is a central tumor. Two-thirds are hilar or perihilar. A few are peripheral, but the majority are central. It's the most aggressive tumor with a rapid doubling time. And oftentimes the metastases are seen early, even at the time of diagnosis. And the common metastatic sites are liver, bone, and brain. Again, the strongest association with tobacco dependency. There's an early response to therapy, chemoradiation, but eventually it becomes refractory and it carries a very poor prognosis. If you look at the bottom, median survival without treatment is less than 6 months, so it is pretty deadly tumor. For limited stage, again, I said it's generally confined to one hemithorax. Extensive stage extends beyond the hemithorax, and the majority of patients present with extensive stage at the time of presentation. It's associated with paraneoplastic syndrome, so keep that in mind. If you have ectopic ADH or ACTH secretion, you may want to look for lung cancer. Eaton-Lambert syndrome, as you are well aware. The treatment includes chemotherapy and radiation. Surgery is not always and is not generally not an option. Prophylactic cranial irradiation is done as well if it's needed. As far as the pathology is concerned, generally, I like to remember that blue is bad. So even if you don't know what you're looking at, blue is bad. What you see here is extensive necrosis and nuclear molding. And there are special stains that generally stain positive in small cell. The CD56 synaptophysing chromogranin. You don't need to know that. That's probably if you're for specialty boards. But just know that there are specialty stains. So if you read a pathology report and you see those stains, you'll know, you know, it's referring to small cell. Squamous cell carries the best prognosis. It's generally a large central mass. So you have central tumors being small cell and squamous cell. If you can remember, they all start with an S sound, if that helps you remember. Sometimes the large central mass can cause obstruction or atelectasis. 10% can cavitate. It's one of the tumors that has been known to cavitate. That's often a question that's asked. Again, associated with smoking, paraneoplastic syndromes, hypercalcemia can be seen, as well as Pancoast syndrome. As far as the pathology slide, the path is concerned, the hallmark feature is keratin pearls. And if I had a laser pointer, I'd show you that one little pearl that's in that slide. But don't worry about it. Adenocarcinoma is the most common non-small cell lung cancer. It's peripheral in location. It can metastasize widely even before symptoms start. It is the most common type of bronchogenic carcinoma seen in non-smokers. Keep that in mind, especially in women, but men can have it too. But non-smokers, you think adenocarcinoma. Let me go on. It's a very glandular tumor. The one thing I do want to point out is not only can you see a peripheral mass that you see on the x-ray slide on the right, but it can also present as a ground glass pattern as well. So, you know, if your patient is being treated for pneumonia, they don't get better, they have this pattern, please be concerned about an underlying malignancy. And which brings me to the point that you always, always, always want to follow chest x-ray to resolution, or a CAT scan to resolution. Again, you see the glandular feature of the adenocarcinoma. This actually is a nice slide I took from UpToDate. It shows the different stains and the associated tumor types. For adenocarcinomas, generally TTF1 positive. Other non-small cell cancers, they're TTF1 negative. And then you have the neuroendocrine, the chromogranin and NSC stains are positive for small cell. Those are generally the common things that are asked, or maybe not on your boards. Adenocarcinoma in situ, one of the new names, not bronchoalveolar cell, generally peripheral. It has a lipidic growth, which is one of the characteristic features. And the other subtypes I'm not going to go into, but remember that it can be associated with seen in non-smokers. Again, the infiltrate, follow it till resolution. Large cell lung cancer, 95% are undifferentiated. They present as large masses. They're centrally located. They have a rapid growth, so keep that in mind. And then you have the large cells. See them? You don't need to know the path slide. That's of the other types of lung cancers, I'm not going to go through the adenoid cystic and the mucoepidermoid, but I will talk a little about carcinoid, which you may see the typical and atypical forms. It is a neuroendocrine tumor. GI is the most common site. Lung is the second most common site. Generally, these patients are younger in age, and they're non-smokers. It affects the central airways, so when you're looking at x-rays and you see subtle atelectasis or a volume loss, you may want to proceed with a CAT scan to see if there's anything endobronchial. These tumors can be endobronchial. They can present with hemoptysis in your younger patients as well. So keep that in mind. Fewer than 2% are associated with carcinoid syndrome. When you classify carcinoid, you have your typical and atypical forms. The typical carcinoid is a low-grade tumor, rarely metastasizes, whereas your atypical is an intermediate grade tumor. It can have it has a higher mitotic rate as well. So in looking at path slide, you can see these nice little rosettes. I think it's pretty, but it looks like a little palette of rosettes. So it looks pretty, it doesn't look as angry as your small cell slide. And the other thing to keep in mind is that you can have central tumor, endobronchial tumor causing obstruction. So that's one of the features you want to keep in mind. Most bronchial carcinoids are non-secretory and they don't metastasize, but some do, and some can produce the carcinoid syndrome. That's an example of an endobronchial carcinoid tumor. And if you look at the slide, it's pretty obvious you have something in the right base. But it's not always that obvious. Sometimes it's just an elevation of the right hemidiaphragm telling you that something's hiding and pulling that diaphragm up or pulling that. Pancoast syndrome is a superior sulcus tumor, which they may ask you about. You have brachial plexus involvement, Horner syndrome with ertosis, meiosis, and hidrosis. And one of the things, if you take a closer look at the vertebrae, you may see local erosion of the ribs. And superior vena cava syndrome, generally 95% are caused by malignancy, lymphoma being one of the common ones that's seen. Predominantly for lung, you can see small cell or squamous cell. And there it is, you have the huge mediastinal mass and the compression of the vessels. Metastasis with lung cancer can occur in just about every organ system. The most common is the liver, brain, and bone. You can have obvious and lymph nodes, but generally keep those in mind. If someone comes in with neurologic deficits or ambulatory dysfunction, keep something to keep in mind. In evaluating your patient, you want to stage them clinically and pathologically. Obviously, a good history and physical examination. They may come with a cough, hemoptysis, exposure history, smoking. With your patients that have a chronic cough, like your COPD patients, the important thing to elicit from them is, has there been a change in your cough? Has there been a change in the color of your sputum, a quantity of sputum? So that's what you want to elicit from them. Are they coughing up blood? Is there any weight loss, unintentional weight loss, constitutional symptoms of other kinds, night sweats, things of that sort. After your chest x-ray, you want to get a CAT scan, and then you may proceed with a PET scan if you do find any abnormalities. Back in the day before PET scans, we used to do CT scan head to toe, head, chest, abdomen, pelvis, and then a bone scan. But now PET scans may obviate that need, so it's pretty readily available. One important thing to don't ever forget is you want to review any prior films. Very important to assess how quickly is this mass or nodule growing, or has it been there for a decade? Very important in terms of, your diagnostic evaluation. How are you going to proceed? Are you going to go with biopsy, surgical evaluation, whatever the case? Prior films, very important. In making your diagnosis, obviously tissue is necessary, and there are various ways you can proceed with that. You can start with a bronchoscopy, or depending on the location, it may necessitate a mediastinoscopy or a VATS procedure. There are new bronchoscopic modalities available that really have decreased the need for sending the patient for a surgical lung biopsy. You have endobronchial ultrasound and navigational bronchoscopy, which are excellent tools, and they can go out way into the periphery and get that nodule that's out in the periphery. They can get it centrally, but definitely peripherally to get your tissue diagnosis. It may not be, if it comes back non-diagnostic, then that's another story. In addition to, they can also do cryobiopsies, which is a little bigger chunk of tissue. So there are other less invasive modalities of getting tissue versus sending them to the OR. PET scans are a very useful tool, especially, keep in mind your lesion has to be at least 8 millimeters or greater for it to be sensitive enough to pick up. Not all, there are false positives for PET scans, keep that in mind. Inflammation can cause your PET scan to light up. If you have lymph nodes, they can light up. So, put it in clinical context. Again, clinical presentation, very important. We talked about the cough, weight loss, constitutional symptoms, hemoptysis, any signs and symptoms of metastatic disease, such as bone pain, joint pain, keep that in mind. 10% may be asymptomatic. It may be, you know, something that you found on screening. So that's also, you know, something very important to make sure that if they are eligible for screening, that you do send them for screening. And we'll talk about that in the next few slides that are coming up. Some of the associated presentations, especially if you have endobronchial involvement, again, I said atelectasis, subtle elevation of the hemidiaphragm or the fissures being pulled up, something of that sort. You know, it may not be as obvious as a big tumor in the lung that's, you know, spiculated or around or whatever the case may be. Pleural effusions, pericardial effusions that are unexplained definitely need evaluation. Hemoptysis, we already mentioned. As far as lung cancer screening is concerned, you all know about the article that was published about the cancer screening guidelines. And generally, that's a summary slide. Anyone ages 55 to 74 with a 30-pack year smoking history or someone that's quit within 15 years, they're eligible for a low-dose CT scan every year. If that low-dose CT scan comes back abnormal, then you, depending on, you know, what the result is, will determine whether you'll proceed with a scan the following year or do it in 3 months, 6 months, whatever the case may be. So with the increased screening with low-dose CT, we've generated a lot of abnormalities, identifying nodules, endlessly. There's so many nodules that are being evaluated. And some don't really need to be evaluated. This is a slide of the Fleshner Society guidelines. They were updated in 2017. And it goes through your guidelines for solid nodules and then your nodules, subsolid nodules. Let's see if I can go back. I can't go back. Oh, boy. There we go. Okay. So as far as your solid nodules are concerned, you want to then, you know, categorize your patient. Is your patient low risk or are they high risk for malignancy? High risk, obviously, being, you know, smoking, we'll say, for easy sake. If your nodule is less than 6 millimeters, you can do a scan in a year. If it's 6 to 8, it falls in that, don't know quite yet what it's going to do. You can do one in 6 months and then 12 months and follow it for a couple of years. If it's larger than 8 millimeters, you may want to, depending, do a CAT scan in 3 months or proceed with a PET scan. You also, you know, before you do all these tests, you also want to, you know, keep in mind the patient's functional status. You know, if you're not going to do anything with these results, then, you know, have a conversation with the patient saying, look, we can do X, Y, and Z, but if you're not going to do anything about the, you know, the nodule that's going to grow, is it worth putting you through all of that? So have that conversation if the patient is not doesn't have a good functional status. As far as subsolid nodules are concerned, whether, you know, they can be ground glass, part solid, here you want to screen, you want to follow them a little bit longer, at least 5 years. And depending, if they have continued, you know, risk factors, you may want to follow them longer. As far as the treatment is concerned, generally for small cell lung cancer, you know, radiation and chemotherapy are your options, and prophylactic cranial irradiation can be used as well. So the options are fairly limited. For non-small cell stage 1 and 2, you have, you know, surgical resection can be the curative, or you may need, depending on the path slide, post-operative chemotherapy as well. Stage 3, generally, sometimes surgery is an option, sometimes it's not. Again, surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, or a combination of those. And 4 is basically palliative or chemotherapy, depending on your patient's functional status and their wishes. Generally, treatment is contraindicated if they have metastatic disease. But if they have something that's, you know, causing significant obstruction and you want to offer them some kind of treatment for palliative measures, say endobronchial stenting or radiation or whatever the case, then that certainly needs to be on the table. Malignant effusions, obviously, contralateral lung mets, the list is there. There's always research being done about on molecular targets in lung cancer, and then you have a lot of inhibitors, tyrosine kinase inhibitors being one, that can play a role in the treatment of lung cancer. As far as solitary pulmonary nodules are concerned, what to do with them, to resect or not resect, that's the big question. And generally, if the patient is young, otherwise healthy, if they have no other, risk factors or surgical risk, then maybe you want to consider taking it out. If it's shown a lack of growth, then you may want to just leave it in. If it shows some calcification, just a note about calcification. If you have popcorn calcifications, that's classic for hematomas. If you have central calcifications, that often points towards benignity. If you have eccentric calcification in a nodule, then that may be malignant. But then, are you talking about eccentric versus popcorn and you don't know what's going on? So my feeling is, when in doubt, take it out if they're an adequate surgical candidate. This is just a slide that's often, I put this in there just as a summary slide. Oftentimes questions are, come up, what things happen in the anterior mediastinum, middle mediastinum, and posterior mediastinum. So that's just a summary slide for you to review. As far as lung neoplasms, I'm just going to talk briefly about the adenomas and the hamartomas. Most adenomas are central. They're slow-growing endobronchial lesions. Again, they may cause that subtle atelectasis, elevation of the fissure or the hemidiaphragm that you may want to evaluate further. Most of them are carcinoids. Hamartomas, I mentioned, they have that classic popcorn calcification. It's a nodule, is usually incidentally found. It doesn't generally cause any symptoms. If you don't know really what's going on, then you may, opt to take it out, especially if it's shown growth. That's an example right at the diaphragm. It's got some calcium in it, of hamartomas at the base of the lung. Paraneoplastic syndromes. I didn't do a whole lot of slides on this. I did a summary slide because you can have paraneoplastic syndromes associated with small cell, non-small cell as well. Generally, they're clinical syndromes. They're mediated by humoral factors that are secreted by the tumor cells themselves. 10% of lung cancers can present with paraneoplastic syndrome. So if you have someone with unexplained hypercalcemia, I think I skipped the slide. Yes, I did. If you have someone with unexplained hypercalcemia or joint pain, you want to think, I shouldn't say backwards, but be mindful of the possibility of lung cancer as well. So this is a summary slide that I think you might find helpful of the different paraneoplastic syndromes associated with the different lung cancers. With adenocarcinoma, you can see hypertrophic pulmonary osteoarthropathy, small cell, you have SIADH, Cushing syndrome, carcinoid syndrome, Eaton-Lambert, or peripheral neuropathies can be seen as well. Hypercalcemia with squamous cell, and then you can have Cushing's syndrome with bronchial carcinoid. Just a quick word about the hypercalcemia. It's tumor secretion of PTH, squamous cell being the most common, and it occurs in 10 to 25% of lung cancer patients. So that's, I think, a fairly significant amount. SIADH, keep that in mind. Hyponatremia is unexplained hyponatremia. Lung cancer should be at the top of the list there. Cushing syndrome I talked about. Now this I wanted to point out because it may not be on your boards, but I think it's something to keep in mind clinically as well. Hypertrophic pulmonary osteoarthropathy presents, you can see digital clubbing. You can also see painful symmetric arthropathy and periosteal newborn formation in association with non-small cell lung cancer. And the reason I put it up there is because a lot of patients have arthritis and joint pain. And so if you have someone with that and you see clubbing, look for lung cancer. This is a scan showing periosteal new bone formation in the lower limbs.